As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide makes simplicity a priority so financial professionals can help their clients achieve their retirement goals. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
Joining us on this program here in New York, Tom Porcelli, RBC Capital Markets Chief U.S. Economist. Good morning to you, Tom.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
You and I have talked for a number of months. Go on.
Sorry, he's not still behind me, right?
No, he's moved. He's gone.
Tom Keene's shadow literally, like,
he's literally looming over you.
I've now checked the internal system. He has walked out of the building.
It was priceless. I'm sorry.
Jonathan. Confusing a return to trend growth with a journey to somewhere a whole lot more worrying. We've talked about this so many times through much of 2019. Now some people confusing full employment with a cyclical peak in labor market conditions. You've written about that.
Yes.
Just explore it further for us.
Yeah. So I think one of the interesting things is I think people get caught up in sort of headlines. And I don't mean news headlines. I mean sort of, you know, headline economic stuff. And one of the things I think people get lost in is, particularly if you're looking at sort of the, you know, employment to population ratios, or if you're looking at labor force participation rates. And I think if you look at the headlines on these things, they've not really done all that much. And I think it leads people to sort of, you know, draw this conclusion that we're still not even remotely close to full employment. But what we've been saying to people is, okay, but you can't look at those specific headlines. You need to look at the cyclical part rate. You need to look at the cyclical employment to population ratio. And when you do that, cyclically, what I mean is, you know, sort of the prime working age cohort, so the 25 to 54 year olds. And when you do that, what you see is that those measures have all improved dramatically, which from our perspective, again, if you look at whether it's the part rate or the employment to population ratio, we're above where we were in the previous cycle. And so it's really easy to make the case that if you're not at full employment, you're really, really close.
I guess when I see the headlines of economic stuff, as you put it, my big question is, should I be bullish or bearish today, right? I mean, is that basically, so given the fact that we are seeing better employment than expected, is that a bull argument or a bear argument?
You know, it's funny, and Jonathan and I have certainly had this conversation before. It seems all of a sudden now, today, like literally over the last like week or two, that good is good again. Right, which is sort of perverse because good was bad, bad was good. Right? We had all these like weird sort of iterations, right? Which is utterly ridiculous in every way. But now all of a sudden today, good is good. And but again, I stress, this is over the last week or two, and I'm defining that in terms of sort of the many clients that I speak to on a pretty regular basis. And the thing I find utterly amusing about that is nothing has changed. Literally nothing has changed over the last week or two. You know, all of a sudden everyone is like feeling a little bit better about the backdrop. So I don't know whether it is, you know, maybe people are, you know, sort of coming to grips with the reality that maybe something is going to get done on trade. Although I would hasten to add that anytime anyone gave me like the bear case for things, they never started it off with trade. But again, maybe that's fair. Maybe it's the equity market is up 23% year to date. I don't know what it is, but all of a sudden people are feeling a little bit better about the backdrop. And I think that's all well and good. But I think I'm just waiting for the next shoe to drop now, because I'm telling you, the vast majority of people that I spoke to prior to the last week or two have been overwhelmingly negative. But now all of a sudden people are feeling a little bit better about the backdrop. Which I find silly, because I'm not sure that they're basing it on anything sound.
So Tom, could that next shoe...
I want to make sure that point is not left out there in ether. I've never thought that people should be negative. They were. So, sorry.
So would that next shoe to drop be the consumer? The consumer is arguably the only thing holding up this economy. Maybe it's because of the... At or near full employment.
Yeah, sure. I think there's no question that the consumer is sort of, you know, pulling a lot of weight, right? They're punching way above it, of their weight. But I think if you want to make the argument for the demise of the consumer, you got to really I don't even know where you'd go to find that. I mean, again, let me be clear. I don't look through the world with rose-covered glasses. But I think the labor backdrop's incredibly tight. Wage pressures continue to build. The level of saving in the United States, whether it's sort of just consumer or total private saving, is incredibly elevated, meaning that there's even some cushion should the consumer sort of suffer through some bout of hesitation. So I would say that it's really difficult to make the case that the consumer's about to roll over when all evidence to the contrary, right? The consumer's in phenomenal shape.
The division of the Fed has turned into unity, it seems, over the last couple of weeks. What do you make of that?
And Tom and I were talking about this on TV a little while ago. I mean, the fact that Evans, you know, wasn't one of the folks looking for a cut after the most recent meeting, the meeting prior. I mean, he said he wasn't one of the folks looking for a cut. I mean, I think for me we sort of had always thought that they would have a hard time getting more cuts anyway, but that really drove home for us. It's like, you know, the hurdle for additional cuts right now is so significant when you have all these extreme doves basically on the same page at this point. So I think it would take real deterioration from here. By the way, let's not forget, next year is an election year. And while anyone who's done this for any lengthy period of time knows that the Fed has engaged in policy action during election years, it usually takes a heck of a lot for them to engage. So I think Fed on hold is for the coming year is absolutely the right call, which the market seems to be buying into.
So you're saying that you don't want to be seen as having too much of a rose-colored view of the world, but also you've never been negative. And this nuance...
That's not true, though. No. Sorry.
I've never
been negative?
No, yeah, you've been negative.
Okay, good.
But I'm saying that you've been generally positive this
recently,
year.
Absolutely, recently, absolutely, which has been really easy.
Okay, so you've generally been positive. You also don't want to be too rosy.
Yeah.
This nuance, I think, is getting lost in this market and difficult for people to read because it has been so monolithic in its story. Either the Fed was backing it or trade was going to torpedo it. What's the sort of trade around this in terms of, you know, does that mean markets go up or down?
Yeah. So what I would say is, I think, you know, one of the things that we had built into our view was that yields would actually start to rise. Yields would start to rise only after we got a trade deal done. Now, in fairness, we always thought a trade deal was going to get done, but we've been thinking of it more in terms of, like, you know, sort of a first half of 2020 event, like sort of, you know, sometime early in the first half of the year, you get a trade deal done. So it's happening a little bit sooner than we thought. And so if you look at our forecast, we had built in a rise in yields in the second half of next year. If they do sign this deal, I think it's really easy to make the case that yields continue to rise from here. So I think it's not a good backdrop from a yield perspective in the United, or from a bond perspective in the United States, because yields will rise. I think on the back of this deal, I think the equity market, and I think our strategist, our equity strategists are more or less in line with this view as well. You know, the equity market is going to perform well again in the coming year too, right? It's, again, if the fundamental pieces remain in place for that to happen, it's really easy to make that case.
Tom Porcelli, always great to get your thoughts.
Thanks,
good
everyone.
To see you, buddy. Tom Porcelli, RBC Capital Markets Chief U.S. Economist.
We're fortunate to have David Kirkpatrick in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker studio.
I'm fortunate to be here.
There you go. David's a Tech Omni CEO and founder. So, David, I know you look at all things tech. You've got just a great view of what's happening in Silicon Valley. Is what's going on here with, you know, you look at Uber, you look at Lyft, you look at WeWork pulling that deal, the Smile Direct deal. There seems to be a disconnect between private market valuations coming out of Silicon Valley and SoftBank and public markets. What do you make of that this year?
Well, SoftBank, I think, had a extreme impact on the markets, the private markets' opinion about what a company could be worth. Masayoshi Son believes he can be a kingmaker. He can identify which CEOs can take a company and make it into the next Facebook. I think to some extent, the existence of Facebook in particular confused a lot of people, thinking that that could happen in any industry. And that's sort of the logic behind investing all that money in Uber or WeWork, which SoftBank did. I think we do now have something of a bubble. Which I think SoftBank is the single biggest contributor to. So in that sense, it's a problem.
It's a problem. So the issue when you look at what Masa-san is saying here is full steam ahead. Our vision is still very much intact. We're going to raise another $100 billion fund. We're going to keep doing this. At what point does, you know, Silicon Valley maybe, some of the more Sand Hill Road folks, the venture capital folks in Silicon Valley, push back a little bit and say, listen, we have a voice at this table. We think the valuations you're putting on some of these companies is just too much.
That's a good question. I think in a lot of the companies, you know, one of the things that's happened with SoftBank is since they have been the lead investor on so many subsequent rounds in specific companies, they keep raising the market cap of companies that they, so they're showing a paper gain in their earlier investments, and a lot of other Silicon Valley venture capitalists are coming along with that. It's hard for them to complain, because if SoftBank's willing to put in money into Uber, you know, WeWork at $47 billion, and you're another VC that put money in at $5 billion, you like that, right? Until right. it's worth $8 billion. Now, in many of these cases, that deflation hasn't yet occurred. So I think in general, you're not seeing a massive reaction against SoftBank. People just hope it continues to succeed.
Well, here's my question. If you are saying that there is something of a bubble here, how does it burst?
Well, I think it's burst in the Uber and WeWork cases already, and that has got a lot of people nervous.
So you think that we've seen the extent of the pain there?
Well, here's one thing that I really think is going to be closely followed, and that is what happens to the money that SoftBank has thrown after bad in the case of WeWork, because they're putting even more money in to save the company, right? They could have sort of walked away. I think that's if WeWork somehow stabilizes and finds a path to profitability, which I can't see happening in any near term, but if it were to happen, basically that stanches sort of a whole flood of negative stuff that could otherwise happen. Also, if Uber could somehow figure out a way to be profitable, some people say their food delivery might be the key. It's a big part of their business, believe it or not. But I don't see a big fundamental shift happening in terms of the psychology.
Every time we used to discuss these companies, we talk about how they've disrupted the industry. Do you remember that? Disrupted was like the buzzword of several years ago. Every conversation, disruption, disruption. They have destroyed industries. And I just wonder what happens to these industries once these companies show they can't make a profit.
I don't fully buy that way of looking at it.
Well, push back then, please.
I mean, I think that, you know, I was saying this on TV before, you know, Masayoshi Son has done something very positive in the conviction he's had about the technology, the ability of digital technology to transform global economies. And I believe that is happening. And I think he has been ultimately one of the biggest cheerleaders for that and put his money where his mouth was. And I think that's not bad. I think many of these industries needed a kick in the pants. And I don't think that you've seen, I don't worry as much as you seem to worry about the value destruction that's happened, say, in the taxi industry, which was an industry largely controlled by the mafia in many cities, right? So, hey, you know, it took a tough guy like Travis Kalanick to come in and shake it up. That wasn't all bad.
David Kirkpatrick, we'll continue the conversation another time. Techonomy CEO and founder. Time is up. It's not that I don't want to argue. I promise you I do.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more. Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Pleased to say that phoning in and joining us now, Jeff Yu, UBS Wealth Management, head of the UK Investment Office, joining us out of London. Good morning to you, Jeff.
Morning.
We remain underweight equities. That's the line from you guys still. Why, Jeff?
Well, you know, right now, we just think there needs to be a distinction between pricing out the downside and pricing in the upside. I think these two are separate things, and we may have started to confuse the two a bit, you know, at this point, and I think it's important to make that distinction. Look at where earnings growth is heading, just look at where economic growth is heading. I think it's a bit too early to pop the champagne bottle corks in for now.
So, Jeff, we got some European economic data today, a little bit better on the margin. What do you take of that?
Well, I think it's important to look at what's better. So on the services side, it's all looking a bit better. But can we say the same for manufacturing and taking a step back? What actually is driving Europe? What are the drivers of Europe? If you look at German factory orders out today, down to 5.4% year on year. Sure, the monthly number was better, but I still think there are quite a few challenges up ahead, and that will only strengthen the conversation whether fiscal is going to happen.
Jeff, how much pushback do you get from your clients?
Not as much as one would think, I think. I think for the last two or three years, with the exception of maybe, December, last year, it has been a case of owning this rally reluctantly. I think the whole market's reluctant bulls them right now. U.S. equities, being a big overweight, for example, because there's simply a lack of alternative. And I don't think that's changed, too much. However, I would say that this talk of late cycle probably, has compared to even a year or two ago and has really come off, so we're just taking a day at a time. I don't think there's too much pushback, but there is a bit of an opportunity cost of not being more aggressively in the market, and it's something that we'll be cognizant of.
Jeff, let's talk about the trade negotiations. The so-called negotiation gaps have closed. I just wonder, what's left? Is that a cause for concern or hope?
It's not a cause of concern per se, because I just still think there's a disconnect between what the market's expecting and what realistically the two sides can actually put forward. For the best part of the summer, China's been stressing it's important to separate the structural issues and the second track of IP, of tech, things like that, from the tariff side of things. The tariff side was always going to be the easier one, political window dressing versus the long-term structural issues, which will be a multi-year, even a multi-decade process. So I don't think those gaps are that wide at all. But our markets are looking for more at this point. And on balance, I would say yes. So I think that's where there is scope for some disappointment. But we have to bear in mind shorter term relief. That's always welcome. And it's something that we can look forward to.
A lot of people have been talking about how trade tensions have already impeded certain businesses. Mm-hmm. Are there certain businesses that you stopped investing in because of the effect of the ongoing trade skirmishes?
I really think you're seeing this across the board, and that's why it's important to keep relatively conservative in a growth forecast for next year. On the one hand, for companies directly involved in trade on the front lines, whose products will be hurt by tariffs, clearly they need to hold back on investment. But then that will filter down through the supply chain, right? So if there's a general slowdown in growth, take Eurozone for example, that's being impacted. Then further down the supply chain, it will impact services, it will impact manufacturing as well. So the inputs into the companies being invested. So I think that's holding back investment in general right now. It's holding back CapEx, and it's something that, again, governments may have to step in terms of fiscal.
There's just a view that things have got better, that the probability of escalation risk between the United States and China has diminished, and Brexit risks have receded as well, Jeff. The Prime Minister is speaking outside number 10 Downing Street at the moment. Yep. The campaigning has already started. The government, he says, has an oven-ready Brexit deal. What's the guidebook for the next 5 weeks in the UK and the issues around Brexit for markets?
Well, I think rule number one is don't believe a thing that the polls are saying, right? We've all been there before on both sides of the Atlantic, so I think that's important to take into account. And also, manifesto promises, whether that can be realised is a separate issue. But I do think we can see some convergence in terms of everyone's going to be pledging to actually spend a bit more. So that may make life a bit easier, for those worried a bit about growth. But I would say follow things as they go along, and just bear in mind, this deal right now, it's a withdrawal agreement. We're still some ways to go, before establishing the long-term relationship between the European Union and the UK. And of course, when we get to the 12th, the evening may throw out some surprises, and we'll just go from there.
So, Jeff, it's interesting. I think it's one could argue, as you just mentioned, don't believe the polls, and it's all going to come down to the election. That sounds to me like I'm just sitting on the sidelines here. I mean, it's way too close to call here. Lots of different things could actually occur here. Is that kind of what you're hearing from some of your clients?
Totally. And if you look at, you know, how we're positioning for this, and you take FX, for example, the move in sterling we've seen is the pricing out of no deal risk, right? So similar with trade. You know, you want to price out the risk of a total breakdown or further escalation. But to go beyond, say, 132 and cable, you know, to make a dash through 135 or to 140, you know, that's going to be a more medium-term issue. We have to establish, you know, so A, you know, what happens after the election, and B, you know, what that long-term relationship is going to be as well. So for now, it's a holding pattern. You've taken off your underweights, you've removed some of your shorts, but that's again different from going long.
So if there is some sort of Brexit agreement in the near term, are you going to flood into London real estate?
There have been plenty of questions on that, you know, from our international clients. You know, that's a traditional source of investment, you know, waiting for John to send in his bids as well. But at the same time, I do think, you know, that will depend, you know, on the overall, you know, regulatory framework, the tax framework, you know, along with, you know, what the government policies, you know, are as well. Because if you look at the market here, it really goes well beyond Brexit. Clearly, the uncertainty has not helped, you know, but there are many moving parts that side of things, but inquiries certainly picking up this year compared to the last 2 years.
Just for the record, I'm not sure I meet the minimum requirements to open a UBS account.
but John,
I don't think I do anyway.
Would you think that you'd buy London real estate, John, or do you think it would be countryside?
Are you trying to get me in trouble?
Totally.
On this show?
100%.
Look, I think there's going to be a lot of appetite for London real estate, given that it's been held back so much, Jeff, but you've got to get over several obstacles. One is not just the divorce agreement. The next is the agreement beyond that. What does the future relationship look like? And I just wanted, Jeff, to that degree, the wall of capital that some people think exists that is waiting to go into the UK, does it wait for the election to end, or does it wait for the next stage of discussions with the European Union to close?
I don't think it will need to wait for the next European discussion, because if you look at some of the international, you know, interest, very little of that over the last, you know, decade or two, you know, has been for the UK's relationship, you know, for the EU. I think, you know, that's just an asset allocation diversification. They see this as an attractive market. So I think that side of things, unless you're an entrepreneur that wants to invest in a business, and let's say, you know, there's a commercial element to it, perhaps the EU negotiations will matter. But for private individuals, I think that's secondary. Yeah.
Just before we let you go, Jeff, let's get a conviction call from you. What's the big call from you guys at the moment?
So still, I would say we will push back against the notion of adding aggressively to risk. We prefer to be somewhat underweight, clip the coupon, you know, clip the dividend, and then just focus on the growth outlook and see, you know, where the next catalyst, you know, comes from, but staying underweight for now.
Hey, Jeff, always great to catch up with you. If you change the call, no doubt, give us a call and we'll catch up. Jeff Yu, UBS Wealth Management, head of the UK Investment Office, joining us out of London on Trade Talks, Brexit, and where to put your money or where not to put it.
Well, the on-again, off-again momentum behind the trade deal between the U.S. and China seems to be on again. The momentum, again, seems to be building a little bit, maybe even get a phase one type of deal signed next month. That would be good for financial markets, including emerging markets. To get the latest, we welcome Esther Law. Esther is an emerging markets fixed income portfolio manager for Amundi Asset Management, located in London. Esther, thanks so much for joining us. So give us your sense of kind of how you think this trade negotiation is going, and what might be in a trade one, a phase one type of deal, and kind of what you think that would mean for emerging markets.
Yeah, good morning. I think the deal, like a mini deal, is somehow already priced in. But nonetheless, when we have a confirmed mini deal or phase one deal comes through, there should be some relief in emerging market assets, especially on EMFX, which has been lagging the move in the hard currency bonds in particular.
You know, I got to say, we get these headlines every day. President Trump coming out and either indicating it's a go or it's not. Today, it's a go. On the Chinese side, we have gotten a little bit of conflicting messages. Overnight, there was a report saying that they were worried that they were giving in too much to Washington and not getting enough in return. How concerned are you about that type of line out of the PBOC and out of Premier, out of Xi Jinping?
I think having seen so many back and forth, like you said, the market is much more massaged and used to this uncertainty. I am a bit worried, more because of the price actions getting ahead of itself, thinking that there'll be more than just, like, let's say, a pause in the tariff. But I really don't expect a very smooth and straight road on this trade war. I do think that there will be constant back and forth, and volatility will just become part of our lives.
So, Esther, as it relates to emerging markets, I mean, maybe I'm just too risk adverse, but it's awful difficult for me to envision investors taking any type of bullish stance on emerging markets generally, given this trade uncertainty, which may or may not be resolved in the next couple of months.
I think, yes, the trade uncertainty has, you know, will not be a positive sign, and it will continue to weigh on more growth forecasts going forward. However, I think we are in a world that is offset by the very loose monetary policy globally, and that has really made EM fixed income in particular looking very attractive. Ultimately, I think the EM debt returns have a lot to do with the inflows, and should we have the negative yield persistence in the coming months, that will still be relatively supportive for EM fixed income, whereas for EM FX and EM debt, EM equities, that will be a bit more unclear uncertainty.
Esther, what's your highest conviction bet right now?
I think we have to go through our usual list to select a good fundamentals, and ideally which with as less noise as possible. I quite like Russia because I believe the fundamentals are very strong, and they've gone through a lot of adjustments in terms of adjusting to sanctions. So in a way, they are already quite closed in many manners. And the execution of the fiscal rule has been very, very resilient, and that's helping the fiscal matrix becoming very, very sound.
So in terms of Latin America, I know there's so much political uncertainty down there. It makes it very difficult for investors to look at that area with conviction. How are you approaching kind of Latin America broadly defined? Are there any areas that you find of interest?
I think at the moment, with the recent news flows, Brazil is coming out as a more positive on the margin. The FX is still going to be a bit volatile, but I think the passing of the pension reforms has removed a big uncertainty out of the way, and that should start to see external investors going back more into the fixed income market.
So you said the central banks are sort of giving a bit of a tailwind to emerging markets, although today it does seem like the mood is that central banks are moving toward a holding pattern rather than an easing pattern. Is that enough, just a holding pattern here across the board, to continue to support emerging markets?
I think the holding patterns, in a way, are actually positive for the currency to stop the yield spread being narrower. We only need a hold plus a relatively positive backdrop externally. I think that is still a case for EM debt.
Esther Law, thank you so much for joining us. Esther is Emerging Markets Fixed Income Portfolio Manager for Amundi Asset Management, joining us from London.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keen. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.